the desk with a loud rap.
Do not think that because we live like this, you are exempt from Batista's gaze. You are correct. He is afraid. And a man who fears his people is a dangerous one indeed.
How can you support him?
Please, spare me the youthful condemnation. How do you think I keep this family safe? Do not come for my help and then cast stones at me for the manner in which I am able to deliver it. The rebels abhor abuses of power. But do not presume that they wouldn't do the exact same thing as Batista if given the chance.
He removes his glasses, rubbing his face, his shoulders hunched over, as though he is tired of this conversation. Tired of Batista and Cuban politics.
I will make a few calls,
he says after a pause.
But I cannot offer any promises. If I do this, though, you will make me one. Whatever exists between you and this boy, you will stop it. Immediately. I have a duty to protect your mother, your sisters, and I will not shield you if your actions endanger this family. You will not see this boy again. You will not do anything to bring us shame, to attract Batista's ire. Am I understood? If you do, you will no longer be my daughter.
I clear my throat. Pushing past the unshed tears, the fear, the panic, the shame. Yes, sir. I'm dismissed with a curt nod and a clipped,
You may go now.
My legs shake, a prayer running through my mind as I walk to the door. Please save him.
Chapter 13 Marisol. Anna pours us each another cup of coffee once she's finished her story. Between the espresso and the secrets, I doubt I'll sleep much tonight. I had hoped Anna would have the answers I sought, but it seems like my grandmother kept her lover a secret even from her closest friend. All I know is that my grandmother loved a revolutionary, that they were separated when Batista threw him in prison. Was he ever released? I'm sorry I don't know what happened to him, Anna says. Elisa told me he was a friend who had gotten into trouble. Nothing more. When I asked her about it, weeks later, she changed the subject. Your great aunts might be able to fill in the rest of it. If they do know more about my grandmother's past, I'm surprised they haven't shared it by now. There is someone else who might be able to help, Anna adds. Who? Your grandmother's nanny. Magda? My grandmother and great aunts spoke of her fondly. But given the age difference between them, I never considered the possibility that she would still be alive and in Havana. Yes, she's 94 now, but her memory is still quite good. She lives in Santa Clara with her niece. Excitement fills me. How far is that? By car? A few hours or so, depending on the conditions. Luis could take you on one of his days off if you'd like. Are you able to reach her? I ask. Momentarily sidestepping the issue of spending even more time alone with her grandson, her married grandson. It's still early. I can call her tonight. We haven't spoken lately, but I make a point of checking in with her every so often. I can see if she'll meet with you before you leave. I'm sure she will. Your grandmother and great aunts were like daughters to her, especially Elisa. The impression Beatriz and Maria gave me when I discussed this trip with them was that they'd lost touch over time. But hopefully Magda can fill in some of the blanks of what my grandmother was like as a child. Thank you. I really appreciate all you've done to help me. Of course. Elisa would have done the same for me. Any of your great aunts would have. The loyalty in her voice is so absolute, so indelible, that I'm taken aback by its intensity. Surprised their friendship withstood a separation of nearly 60 years. Does she ever feel as though they left her behind? Does she envy the freedom they found on the other side of the sea? Ana Rodriguez operates in both spheres, the before and the after, and while I struggle to understand this new iteration of Cuba, there are similarities between it and the one that developed 90 miles away. The same inherent sense of pride, the determination to be successful, the hard work, the entrepreneurial spirit and ingenuity, the pragmatism, Has it been hard? I ask, seeing the changes in Gua. I'm eager for this piece of Gua she gives me. I grew up on the stories of those who left, of exile, of loss, and yet I never understood it from the other perspective. Those who were left behind, who chose to remain, whose lives were shaped by the whims and policies of governments, by ideology. Yes, she sighs, taking a sip of her cafecito. The story of Cuba is one of struggles and strife. When we were girls, we were kept from most of it, but the edges seeped through, crawling over the gates. Batista was a harsh president. He loved sugar, loved the money that flowed into the country from overseas, but he didn't love the Cuban people. He wanted to be king over a people who didn't want to be ruled. And yet, she gives me a sad smile. Ah, yes. But we didn't know then, you see. We had hope. So much hope. Remember, Fidel did not start out as a communist, merely an agent for change, one we desperately needed. He was going to bring freedom to Cuba, democracy, elections. He was going to be our future. He promised us a revolution, and he delivered it. But at what cost? I ask. Terrible things rarely happen all at once, she answers. They're incremental, so people don't realize how bad things have gotten until it's too late. He swore up and down that he wasn't a communist, that he wanted democracy. Some believed him, others didn't. Did you? Believe? Support Fidel then? I nod. No. But what did I know or care about politics? I lived in a world of balls and parties, days at the club, lounging by the pool with friends, shopping for hats and dresses. Batista, Fidel, it was all the same to me. Or so I thought. When Batista fled the country, I began to care. Before then, the revolution was contained to whispers between my parents, and then the whispers spread to our dining room table. Did your parents consider leaving? They did, and dismissed it. They were convinced Cubans would come to their senses and Fidel would fall. It's only a matter of time, my father would say. Ana's gaze drifts to the room that has clearly fallen on hard times, the lingering trace of its former grandeur a stark reminder of all her family has lost. No one realized how far this would go. We thought Batista was the worst we would experience. But when Fidel nationalized our rum business, things began to change. She takes another sip of her coffee, her gaze on some memory I cannot see. They came to our home one day with a letter saying the company was now the property of the Cuban government. Just like that, 100 years of labor, of dreams, our legacy erased with one piece of paper. I'm so sorry. I'm not even sure why I'm apologizing or what I'm apologizing for, other than the fact that the Pérezes have managed to keep their family legacy mostly intact, or at least create a new one, whereas she has lost hers. It's been a long time now, Ana replies. There was nothing we could do. My parents left Cuba 6 months later. I never saw them again. We kept in touch over the years as best we could, but it wasn't the same. Even though it was a common occurrence following the revolution, it's difficult to imagine a family being ripped apart in such a manner. There are no Pérezes remaining in Cuba. We all made the crossing to the United States, claiming Miami and Palm Beach as our own, as we embraced polo and dresses with colorful prints. If you don't mind me asking, why did I stay? I nod. Life, I suppose. In the beginning, the plan was for us to reunite in the United States. But my husband didn't want to leave. He was a photographer, and he took many pictures of Fidel and others. It was an opportunity for him to see the revolution up close, to glimpse the men who loomed so large above all of us in their natural habitat. As an artist, it was a powerful lure. She takes another sip of her coffee. I was young. I didn't understand the urgency, the consequences of my decision to stay. I didn't want to leave him. I became pregnant with Luisa's father, and we had a baby and started building a life here, putting down roots in a fragile earth. The thing with loss is that at first you don't notice. You lose your favorite pair of shoes. There's still another. And the baby needs to be fed. And your husband had a long day at work, so why worry? And when you lose the next pair of shoes, well, you've already lost one pair, so the novelty has worn off. You're upset for a moment because now you've lost two pairs. But dinner needs to be made, and when you took your ration card to get food, they were out of milk and chicken again. And who has time to worry about shoes? And this goes on for a time until you realize you're down to your last pair, and they have holes in them. The dirt from the streets covering your skin, the soles falling apart, your toes pinched. And when you're finally able to replace them, there's an overwhelming sense of relief. And you forget you once had 20 pairs, that once you lived like kings, and now you serve on bended knee, fighting for every inch. It's poetic justice, of course. We had everything when much of Cuba had nothing. Fidel took everything away, so now we all have nothing. We are all equal, you see? Except for Fidel, who lived like a king. Luis interjects, sliding into the empty seat next to me without acknowledging my presence. And so many of his top officials continue to do so. How long has he been standing there? Luis lights a cigar, the flame a bright torch that crackles the paper. A familiar scent fills the air. My father's abhorrence of Castro never extended to the expensive cigars he smuggled into the United States. All are equal, but some are more equal than others, I muse. Luis inclines his head toward me. Was that an Animal Farm reference? A hint of what might be admiration lingers in his gaze, coupled with that same indulgent amusement I've come to associate with his reactions to me. I force a smile, attempting to keep my voice light, to not draw notice to how rattled I am by his presence, how my body shifts once he's around, my attention gravitating toward him. It seems supremely unfair that these pings of energy, these sparks flying around me, have found a target they cannot, and should not, have. If the hoof fits, I guess, I joke. A voice calls out from the kitchen for Anna. She excuses herself, leaving us alone, silence filling the room, its presence fairly screaming with discomfort. So you read Orwell? Luis asks after a pregnant pause. I shrug. I have. I'm surprised you've read Orwell. Why? Because I live in a communist paradise? A smile plays on his lips. Playful Luis is perhaps the most lethal version of all. I take a deep breath. Partly. Everything we hear in the United States is centered on the scarcity of resources in Cuba, the banning of ones the government disagrees with on principle. Things are painted as austere. I'm sure that helps with the political rhetoric on both sides, he acknowledges. The evils of communism and all that. And when it comes to the scarcity of resources, well, it helps the regime sell the idea that we're all equal, that your neighbor has exactly what you have, even when your neighbor is a high-ranking government official driving a luxury import. His voice builds with each word, growing from a murmur to something louder, stronger. The confidence in his tone, the conviction, is as seductive as it is surprising. My heart pounds. You're angry. There were hints of his discontent earlier, but now something has changed between us, and it feels as though the mask has fallen, and he's sharing a part of himself he normally keeps hidden away. Angry is the easiest emotion, Luis replies. You'd be surprised what people do when they're desperate. When the dream of a society that provides for its citizens isn't the reality. People thrive regardless of their circumstances? Something like that. The irony of the revolution is that it sought to eradicate capitalism, entrepreneurship. But the revolution's greatest legacy has been the rise of a new breed of Cuban entrepreneurs. The black market thrives. So where does Orwell and Cuba fit in? I ask, returning to our original point. He smiles faintly, his previous rancor erased. You forget, I am a history professor. A Cuban history professor. I thought Castro discouraged such activity, examining the why behind things. How can we study history if we only examine the events in a vacuum? Orwell stopped in the National Library and others. Knowledge is not discouraged in Gua, only acting upon that knowledge. And reading? Reading is encouraged. His lips twist, that tinge of disdain back again. Few can afford to buy books, however, so we borrow them. My students attend the university for free, which is a great thing, but they still must pay for books, supplies, transportation, food, on limited incomes. How can we afford those things when we're barely surviving as it is? When our ability to support ourselves is limited by the government. The legacy of modern Gua is that we can enjoy things for a moment, but we cannot truly possess them. The country is not ours. It is merely on loan from Fidel. If I thought him attractive before, this conversation, the passion that animates him now, is my undoing. Do all Cubans think like this? Speak like this? It surprises me to hear the same thoughts fall from his lips echoed by the exiles hanging around Versailles in Miami, sipping espresso and eating pastelitos while calling for change in Cuba.
Some do. Not enough.
His voice lowers. Those of us who want more speak in whispers. Luis takes a deep breath, leaning forward. His scent fills my nostrils, and once again we're sharing confidences. A line of goosebumps rises over my skin. I glance away from his dark flashing eyes, his full mouth, simultaneously craving his words and wishing I could build an impenetrable wall between us. Existing in a constant state of uncertainty is hell, Luis says. This restaurant is the difference between putting meals on the table and the days when we went hungry. But how long will it last? The government controls everything. A curse falls from his beautiful mouth. This country, it has so much potential, so much possibility, but it breaks your heart every single time you dare hope for more. Fidel's great revolution was supposed to bring us equality, yet so many of the problems that existed before him still do. What would you wish it to be? I ask, meeting his gaze, unable to look away. Have I ever met a man like him? No. Free. Democratic. He lifts the cigar to his mouth, inhaling one deep breath. He exhales a cloud of smoke.
I would like to shout.
The freedom to protest when I do not agree with what my government is doing, without fear of retribution. The freedom to listen to music, without the fear that the regime will accuse me of being too Western and throw me in jail. I don't want to spend my days looking over my shoulder, wondering if my neighbor is really a member of the secret police, that one of the students in my classroom isn't there solely for the purpose of spying on me for the government, that I won't accidentally say something that could result in me being thrown in jail or worse. A chill slides down my spine. This is the Gua my great-aunts warned me about.
I want to own something of my own, Luis continues. Something the government can't take from me. Something that is mine.
If we left, the government would come into our house and inventory every single possession to make sure we didn't take any of it with us. We don't own the furniture, the pieces that have been in our family for generations, the framed photographs on the wall taken by my grandfather. None of it is ours. The urge to take his hand, to offer comfort, is so strong I reach out before I catch myself. I snatch my hand back, my fingers curling into a fist in my lap. This connection between us, I can't be imagining it. He must feel it too. Married. He's married, Marisol. I want to be my own person. His words wrap around my heart. Not another number in the eyes of the government. Another food ration, another worker, another Cuban who isn't free in his own country. My heart breaks for him even as I reach for hope in a place where that particular emotion seems perversely futile. We survive by not calling attention to ourselves, by being good little soldiers. I am tired of putting on the uniform, pretending I'm someone I'm not, unable to think for myself, bearing these thoughts so they don't get me or my family killed. I'm 36 years old, and each day the fight filters from my body.
The effort to exert myself to get through a day and meet my basic needs, to care for my grandmother, for my family, to put food on the table, robbing me of much else. They ensure we're so preoccupied with the daily struggle that there's little left over for the most important one, for taking control of our future. Do you think things will improve now that diplomatic relations have increased?
I hope so. But what change? Will we go from this to serving even more tourists and courting cruise ships?
That was the Cuba of Batista's time,
when the American mob ran Havana with their hotels and casinos, when Hollywood used this as their playground. Is there no chance for Cuba to be something more? Something greater?
The light casts a shadow across his face, the bruise there. Luis rubs his jaw, his gaze downcast.
There are restaurants in Havana my grandmother frequented with her family when she was a little girl. Now only tourists can afford to eat there. We're guests in our own country. Second-rate citizens because we had the misfortune to be born Cuban.
He raises his head to meet my gaze, his eyes defiant.
We do not wear humility well.
Would increased tourism be better, though, than this?
I don't know,
he answers, his voice weary.
It's a cruel twist of fate that we've suffered through all we have to merely end up where we started, and in my family's case, with far less.
It's hard to hope, he continues.
We've known worse times, of course. It was hell when we lost the support of the Soviet Union. The not-so-special period.
Would you ever leave?
This is my home. It's all I've ever known. And at the same time, it's hard. There comes a point when you have to decide if it's worth it, if the abuses are enough to make you want to leave, if they outweigh those few moments when you know true pleasure.
It's the word pleasure that does it.
It's late, and I should go to bed. I shouldn't have hushed conversations with a married man in the near darkness.
I set my glass on the table, rising.
Cristina never understood why I couldn't be happy here, why it wasn't enough.
It was what ended our marriage. I sit back down.
You're separated?
Divorced.
Recently? It depends on your definition of recent, I suppose. It's been 2 years.
But she said she was your wife, I sputter.
A short laugh escapes his beautiful mouth. That sounds like Cristina.
There's affection contained in those words, too.
He takes another puff of his cigar. She doesn't like you.
Why?
He doesn't speak, but then again he doesn't have to. His eyes say it all. That and the memory of his finger brushing mine earlier on the malecón. You know why. You thought I was the sort of man who would...
He doesn't finish the thought, but then again he doesn't need to.
We exist in a state of half-finished sentences. The pauses in our conversation filling the inadequacies of words.
I didn't know.
Now you do. I'm not.
The sort of man who would hit on women when he's married.
I should go up to my room, I say.
I don't move.
Neither does he.
I want to show you something. Will you come with me?
He asks. I teach a morning class at the university tomorrow. You could attend if you'd like and see the Cuban educational experience in person. And after that, I can give you a tour of the island.
Yes.
Chapter 14 Elisa. A day passes, then two, without any news from my father. It takes every ounce of strength to keep from asking him about Pablo, to wipe the fear from my face, to maintain the facade that all is well. I pass the days writing Pablo letters, letters I might never have the opportunity to send, letters in which I finally admit the feelings that have been building for so long. Surely I would know if something has happened to him, if he has passed on. I think I loved you from the first moment you told me about your passion for Cuba, your dreams for her future. I loved your conviction, your strength, the confidence with which you approached the problem, as though it was your right as a Cuban citizen to demand more, to fight for it. I wish I had your courage, your convictions. I wish there was more of a fight inside me. I've been raised from birth to continue on, to survive in this dangerous political climate. My grandfather was killed by Machado's men. Did I ever tell you that? I think it changed something in my father. In all of us. And then there's the rest of it. As much as I am loath to admit that my gender limits me somewhat, it does. I've been thinking about what you said to me that night we met at Guillermo's party, about the changes we should demand in Cuba. Perhaps my gender shouldn't limit me. I read the books you told me about, the ones that inspired you, immersed myself in the words of great men. And I want to believe there is more we can do, more we can expect for our future. But I am also scared, afraid for you, afraid my family, my siblings will be targeted by the regime because of my actions. I wish I weren't so afraid. 4 days after I asked my father for help, he summons me to his study.
I called in a favor. He'll be released.
My heart pounds.
You won't see him again.
It is not a question. I nod. Another day passes before Pablo is released from jail, before I can see him, my promise to my father buried somewhere beneath layers of guilt. I borrow Beatrice's gleaming Mercedes and drive to Guillermo's house, to the place where we first met, and wait for Pablo, looking over my shoulder the entire time. It was my brother who told me they would be here. I'm not entirely surprised Alejandro knows Guillermo, especially considering Beatrice's interest in attending the party at his house that fateful night. When I received the sealed note from Alejandro telling me Pablo would be released this morning, there was never a question of whether or not I would come. For better or worse, I have taken a stand. Not with the rebels, but with my heart. I pray it doesn't fail me now. I wait as the car pulls into the driveway of Guillermo's house. He's in the driver's seat of the Buick, Pablo beside him, sunglasses covering his eyes, his shoulders hunched over, his face partially obscured. My heart pounds. Pablo steps out of the car and stops in his tracks, his hand lingering on the door. He walks toward me, a limp in his gait, a mixture of surprise and what looks to be relief in his eyes. I step into his embrace, holding him gingerly, trying to avoid the bruises, the cuts. Dried blood mars his shirt. What did they do to him? A sob rises in my throat, but I push it down, wanting more than anything to be strong for Pablo. He breathes into the curve of my neck, his lips caressing my skin, his body sagging against me. In this moment, our roles have reversed, and I am the one to provide comfort, strength. My name falls from his lips like a prayer. I want to speak, but no words come. Our bodies shift, our mouths finding each other. I don't even realize I'm crying until tears wet my lips.
It's okay,
Pablo whispers as he strokes my hair. I'm not sure if he says the words for me or for himself. His heart beats against mine, his body shuddering with each breath he takes.
You shouldn't have come, he says,
even though he doesn't sound the least bit sorry I did. How could I not? Pablo's hold on me tightens for a moment before he releases me, as we walk inside the house, Guillermo trailing behind us. Guillermo doesn't speak, but I can feel the disapproval coming off him in waves. Once it would have bothered me. Now I can't summon the enthusiasm to care. Guillermo gives me a cursory nod before leaving to get food for Pablo. And I follow Pablo into an empty bedroom, sitting on the edge of the bed next to him. Do you need anything? I ask.
No.
His gaze meets mine, and when he speaks, his voice is hoarse, as though he's worn it out from screaming.
I met your father.
A moment of silence passes between us before I can reply. I know.
You asked him to have me released?
I did. I am unable to ignore the tiny thread of shame that connects my father to the men who did this. My father's clout is a double-edged sword, both the source of Pablo's freedom and a sign that my family is not innocent in the darker side of life in Havana, the brutalities of Batista's regime.
How did you even know I was arrested?
My brother heard about it. He told me.
And your father? What did you tell him? That you were in love with a revolutionary?
It's the first time the word love has fallen from either of our lips, and hearing it spoken aloud gives it a measure of power I'm unprepared for, even as the truth of it resides in my bones. I told him you were a friend.
And he accepted that?
My father doesn't concern himself over much with the affairs of his daughters. I hesitate. I promised I would never see you again.
So this is goodbye, then?
No. I'm in too deep at this point for goodbyes, although at the moment I can't imagine we're destined for anything else. He can't stay in Havana. Not after this. Should I go with him? Take my chances in the mountains? There are other women fighting there, taking up arms against Batista. I wanted more out of my life, chafed at the bonds of family and society, and still, I'm not ready to join my brother in the ranks of the ostracized and disowned. I'm not prepared to pledge my allegiance to these causes vying for power around me when they leave a foul taste in my mouth. Pablo sighs, sitting on the edge of the bed, his head in his hands.
You should go. You don't belong here.
Of course I do.
You can't stay. Not with me. This is only going to become more dangerous. They would have killed me, Elisa. They will kill me if they capture me again. I can't stay.
You're going to the mountains, aren't you?
Where else would I go? I don't belong here in Havana.
I don't belong here with you.
I saw how your father looked at me in that cell, Pablo continues. We will forever be on opposite sides of this. We are at war. I cannot pretend it does not divide us. Your family will never accept me, and I fear I will never see your father and his friends as anything other than monsters.
He secured your release.
He did. And there were 8 other men in that cell with me. Men who will face the firing squad tomorrow. Not all of them have wealthy girlfriends whose fathers can protect them.
We don't have a chance, do we? I ask, tears building.
I don't know, he answers.
Pablo takes my hand, brushing his lips against my knuckles. I wrap my arm around his waist, careful to keep from hitting his bruises, my head resting against his shoulder, his heart beating beneath me. I hold on to him, even as I feel him slipping away. He was right when we first met. Everything is political. Where does that leave us?
Chapter 15. Marisol. The morning after I learn Luis isn't married, I'm up early, dressing to meet him at the University of Havana. I barely slept the night before. The sensation that everything has shifted, inescapable. The attraction I've felt for him and attempted to shove in the background of our interactions has reared its head, no longer satisfied being confined to the margins, and what was a crush entirely contained in the safety of my imagination is now a crackling tension between us filled with possibility. I change my outfit twice before settling on a long black skirt and matching top. I grab a pair of leather sandals and my trusty crossbody bag. My grandmother's ashes a constant presence on my journey through Gula to the point that it no longer feels unusual to carry her with me. I throw a bathing suit and a change of clothes into a larger tote bag. I don't know where Luis is taking me after his class, but he said it involves swimming. A knock comes at the door. Come in. The door opens and Ana greets me with a smile, her eyes twinkling as she takes in my appearance. Luis mentioned he wouldn't be working at the restaurant tonight. I take it he's showing you more of Cuba? My cheeks flush and I nod. He mentioned swimming. Her smile deepens. It'll be Varadero then.
He's always loved it, ever since he was a child. A hint of sadness dims her smile. He and his father used to go fishing there. She reaches out, handing me a piece of paper. I glance at the words scrawled there, an address. I spoke with Magda last night. Anna says, she can't wait to meet you. I look up at Anna, my heart pounding. I can't believe it. Thank you so much. It was nothing. My pleasure. Varadero is not that far from Santa Clara. You could go there after your trip to the beach. I feel bad asking Luis to go out of his way. I could probably rent a car or something. Some of the guidebooks I read prior to coming to Cuba mentioned tour buses as well. Anna practically winks at me. I don't think he'll mind. Besides, Luis doesn't have classes tomorrow. We can handle his shift at the restaurant. I guess I could ask him. I hedge, torn between my desire to meet with Magda and my guilt over asking Luis to play tour guide for another day. It's settled, then. Please give Magda my best. It's been far too long since we last saw each other. I bite back a grin at the decisive way Anna handles things, as she herds me from the room. She reminds me so much of my grandmother. We part at the bottom of the stairs, Anna heading for the kitchen and the lunch service. Luisa's mom is waiting for me in the entryway, a disapproving glint in her eyes. Are you ready? She asks. I nod. Apparently, Luis shares his car with his mom, so he asked if I minded if she drove me to the university on her way to work and left his car waiting near the campus while he took the bus this morning. What could I say? It couldn't be more obvious that his mother doesn't like me if she came out and said it herself, and unfortunately, the ride into Vedado will likely give her plenty of time to do so. Thank you for giving me a ride. She might not like me, but I can't suppress the urge to change her opinion of me. To demonstrate that I'm more than the shallow foreigner she fears will sink her claws into her son. She shrugs me off. Luis asked me to. My cheeks heat as her gaze drifts to the larger bag in my hands, at the implication contained there. I open my mouth to explain it's not what she thinks. We're going swimming. But she doesn't give me a chance. She turns, leaving me no choice but to follow her outside, where Luisa's convertible sits at the curb waiting for us. With traffic, it takes us nearly 30 minutes to get from Miramar to the University of Havana, and I content myself with staring out the window, watching people pass us by. I attempt a few meager forays into conversation with Luisa's mother. My efforts yield the information that her name is Caridad, the general impression that she views me as an outsider, and not much else. I can't blame her. I'd probably dislike me too, given the disparities between our lives, and the fact that my family benefited from leaving, whereas hers suffered for staying. The question runs through my mind again. What would have happened if we'd never left? If I'd grown up here, alongside Luis? If the revolution had never come? Who would I be if you stripped away the parts of me and just left me with the identity of being Cuban? There's a freedom to life here. No need to check status updates or obsess over someone's posted photos or spend time crafting a cleverly worded line to share with hundreds of followers and friends. And at the same time, that freedom is an incredible indulgence. The abstention of a life available to me. The choice of it. Whereas for the Cubans who live without the barrage of statuses about how much someone loves their spouse, or that picture of a friend from grade school climbing Machu Picchu, arms flung out against the backdrop of a fortuitously setting sun, there is no choice, no freedom. Their exile from these things isn't self-imposed. It was thrust upon them by a government that has been in power their entire lives. And so, the beauty of life here, the simplicity of it, is also the tragedy of it. Caridad drops me off outside the university, handing me the keys to the car to give to Luis as she walks to her job. My first impression of the University of Havana is of an imposing building, beautiful in its own way. The architecture, like that of so many of the other buildings in Havana, is impressive. The landscape marred by the presence of air conditioning units hanging outside the windows, marks on the building's exterior. I climb the steps, staring at the looming alma mater statue.
I walk through the campus, past students sitting on benches, their conversations carrying throughout the outdoor space, the atmosphere reminiscent of my own college experience, following the map Luis gave me until I find his classroom. Here the differences are more visible. The walls are khaki-colored, calling to mind military fatigues. The green chalkboard at the front of the room is a far cry from the modern equipment I knew in my university days. Luis leans over a wooden desk in front of the chalkboard, the sleeves of his blue dress shirt rolled up, his long legs encased in darker blue trousers. He's obviously consumed by whatever he's reading, his head bent, his forearms braced against the wood, and I take the opportunity to sneak in the back, sliding into an empty desk chair. One at a time, students filter into the classroom, discussing their evening plans, the lesson they read. Two girls sit in the row in front of me. One of the girls is convinced her boyfriend is cheating on her, and by the details she provides, I'm inclined to agree. Luis looks up from his desk, his gaze scanning the room. It settles on me. He smiles. That spark is there again, the inevitability of it flaming before my eyes. Luis glances away, the smile still on his lips and in his eyes as he calls the class to order. Today's lesson deals with the French blockade of Cuba in the 16th century, and through the passion in Luis's voice, the French corsair and the struggle of the Cuban people come to life. The time flies as he lectures, the passion he's expressed discussing Cuba in its modern form evident in his appreciation for its earlier history as well. It's even more interesting for me considering I don't know much about Cuban history before and after the narrow window of the revolution. There's sadness in the picture he paints of Cuba's origins, the abuse that the Taínos suffered at the hands of the Europeans who took their lands, the Spaniards' cruelties. He speaks of Cuba's economy, how sugar has been both savior and damnation, bringing slaves into the country to work the plantations until Cuba followed suit with the United States and abolished slavery in the late 19th century. Luis doesn't use aids when he lectures. Rather, he fires questions at his students with an energy that seemingly comes more from excitement than a desire to intimidate. He isn't still when he teaches, his hands in constant motion, his body darting back and forth in front of the green chalkboard. No one watching him teach could doubt how much he loves it, or fail to appreciate his sincerity and passion for the subject. His students are rapt before him, an impressive feat if I remember my college days correctly. The class flies by with surprising speed, and I don't realize it's over until the students begin pushing back their seats, gathering their books and bags, heading for the door. I linger in the rear of the classroom while a few students approach Luis with questions, his focus intense even in this. That's the most attractive thing about him. Not the long, lean build, or the mop of dark hair, the close-trimmed beard, the dark, intense eyes. It's his passion, his intellect, his conviction. And then the students are gone, and it's just the two of us, a classroom of abandoned desks between us.
"So, what did you think?"
he asks once we're alone. "You were good. Really good. Knowledgeable, engaging. I wish I'd had more professors like you when I was in college." There's that smile again.
"They weren't engaging?"
"Not really. A few were, I guess. I went to a huge public university, so my courses were really full. Hundreds of students in a class. It made it tough to connect. Plus, I wasn't necessarily the most dedicated student. It took me a while to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up," I joke. "I majored in communications because I enjoyed most of my classes, and it seemed versatile considering I had no concrete plans for when I graduated. My father suggested I work for Perez Sugar handling public relations, but no matter how lucrative the offer was, I couldn't convince myself to join the family fold. I love my family, but all too often these opportunities come with strings I'm not ready to commit to. Our family history includes a sense of obligation. Being a Perez in Cuba meant something once, a legacy and reputation to uphold, a responsibility to never dishonor the family name. When we lost so much in the revolution and my great-grandparents and their children came to America, that obligation continued, growing into a need to establish ourselves in a society
where we weren't entirely wanted, where we had to work harder to get ahead, where we had to start over in so many ways. It's a weighty responsibility to carry your family's legacy in every step you take, every decision you make, and one I fear I haven't quite measured up to. As a Cuban woman, my family expects me to cook paella with a plum, to dress well, marry well, entertain as though everything is effortless. As someone whose family fought to immigrate to the United States, I am supposed to succeed professionally as well, to be both successful businesswoman and elegant housewife. My grandmother understood, at least. Her sense of pride and obligation measured with a healthy dose of pragmatism and love. Was this why? Because she once dared to go against her family's wishes and follow her heart? And now you know? Luis asks, his expression earnest. I try to smile. I wish. I'm afraid I'm still figuring it out. I want my life to mean something. Want a job that makes me feel the way he looks when he's teaching. Something I'm passionate about that, when I die, leaves the world better than I found it. It's a surprisingly tall order. There's no shame in that, he says. You found it? Luis shrugs. Don't let appearances fool you. I still have my doubts. Still wonder if I am doing enough. If I am on the right path. My family relies on me. I don't want to disappoint them. I know a thing or two about family expectations. I offer a wry smile. It's hard being the future. Everyone's expectations riding on you, isn't it?
It is.
He reaches out, his fingers grazing my cheek, tucking a stray strand of hair behind my ear, before dropping his hand back to his side. So tell me the history of this place, I say, my voice shaking slightly as a tingle slides beneath my skin. Luis crosses his arms and leans against his desk, his gaze speculative.
You want the history lesson? Isn't that what I came for?
The history lesson seems safer than anything else. I've felt the attraction between us building since I arrived, but I'm leaving soon. And as drawn to him as I am, getting involved in something that has no future is a terrible idea. And yet here I am.
Is that what you came for?
Luis asks, his voice soft. He shakes his head at my silence, hiding the smile I hear in his voice with a duck of his head.
The university was founded in the early 18th century, was one of the first in the Americas. It was originally located in Old Havana before moving here in the early 20th century. Batista closed the university in 56 because he was afraid of the radicalization coming out of it. When Fidel reopened it, the university shifted focus and underwent a reformation to be more in line with the revolutionary ideology. He almost delivers the line as though he believes in the merit of such action.
Speaking of revolutionaries, I take a deep breath. Your grandmother got in touch with this woman who lives in Santa Clara. Her name is Magda, and she used to work for my family as a nanny to my grandmother and great aunts. She might know something about my grandmother's past. Could you drive me to Santa Clara to see her? If it's too much, I completely understand. I can rent a car or something. The expression on his face gives me pause. Really, it's no trouble for me to see her on my own. I know it's a long trek.
It's not the distance.
Luis is silent for a moment.
You need to be careful, Marisol.
Do you think it's too dangerous to visit her? My great-aunt's concerns come back to me. All those emails with information from the State Department filling my mind coupled with Luis's earlier warnings. Are they right? Am I underestimating the political reality in Cuba? Am I causing problems for him, for Ana? Will I draw trouble to Magda's doorstep?
I don't know, Luis answers. On the one hand, you're visiting an old family friend. Of course, if this man is a sensitive subject for the regime, merely searching for him could be dangerous. That's the challenge here. Sometimes you know you're agitating the regime. Other times you don't realize they viewed your actions as a threat until it's too late.
I don't want to bring trouble to any of you.
I have a feeling taking you to visit your grandmother's former nanny is the least of my problems, he comments. I'm more concerned about you.
You're as much at risk as any of us.
Your American citizenship isn't going to protect you here. The regime doesn't look kindly toward journalists. Even ones who write about the benefits of color coordinating your closet? I ask, my voice filled with exasperation. You have a voice and a platform. That's all it takes to terrify them. Would you let it all lie? I ask. Me? Probably not. But that's not exactly a vote of confidence. He rubs his cheekbone over the bruise there. How much does this matter to you? I don't want anyone to get hurt because of me, and I don't want to end up in a Cuban prison somewhere. But it's important to me. Luis sighs, and we'll go see her. I was going to take you to Valadero. Santa Clara isn't that much farther. We can go there after we go to the beach. He hesitates. We could stay overnight somewhere to make the trip more manageable, if that's okay with you. I take a deep breath. That sounds perfect. Luis takes my hand and squeezes it, our fingers threading together. He looks as conflicted as I feel, even as he brings our joined hands to his lips, pressing a kiss to my knuckles. Is this to be a fling? A few stolen moments I'll remember fondly in a month or two. A vacation romance and nothing more? I've always been more of a relationship person, and as I try to picture myself sitting at a table with my friends in Miami, sipping cocktails and telling them about Luis, the image feels wrong somehow. There is nothing in his manner either that suggests he's a man prone to flings, his nature more serious than careless. And yet, we're both too old to blindly rush into things, to not know the risks involved, how ill-suited we are on paper. Despite all the things we have in common, the reality is that unless relations between the United States and Cuba drastically change, we're starting down an untenable road. A long-distance relationship takes on a whole new meaning in a country like Cuba, where the internet is so heavily regulated, communication thwarted, tourist travel banned by the United States, Cubans' freedom to travel subject to the whims of the government bureaucracy and economic realities. In a country where the government is a terrifying specter towering over its citizens. How can it be more than just a fling? Are you sure it's okay to go see Magda? I ask again, pushing the niggling doubts about our future from my mind. It probably will be fine, he answers, staring down at our linked hands. If anyone is keeping an eye on you, it'll merely look like you're visiting an old family friend. It's not like they know you're looking for someone. I still... What do you mean if anyone is keeping an eye on you? Are you saying the regime is spying on me? Did it occur to me that they likely monitored Cuban agitators, foreign officials in their country? Sure, but me? The look Luis gives me is exceedingly patient and a little sad. They like to keep tabs on things. But me? I'm writing a tourism article, not a political piece. Yes. And you're also a descendant of one of Cuba's wealthiest and most notorious families. What would you expect? Plus, you're staying here with us. He shrugs. Like I said, they like to keep track of people. Do you think they're following me the whole time I'm here? Probably not. They have limited resources, after all. That said, who knows? The notion that someone has been watching me since I arrived in Havana, however innocuously, is terrifying. Were they there when we sat beside each other on the malecón? Sitting in a pew somewhere in the Cathedral of Havana, pretending to pray while actually logging my movements to report back to some government official? How do you live like this? I ask. Aren't you afraid all the time? You tread carefully, he answers. And then eventually you become inured to their threats and they lose their teeth. You're still careful. But you test the boundaries and limits a bit more each day, because otherwise you would go mad living in a constant state of fear. And that's what terrifies the regime. If the people don't fear them, they lose their power. Luis pushes off from the desk abruptly, tugging me forward and closing the gap between us. I tip my head to stare into his eyes. Ready? He asks. Maybe. I nod.
It takes a little over 3 hours to get from Havana to the beach in Varadero. Luis stops a few times so I can take pictures of the scenery, as I bask in this side of Cuban life. The space between Havana and Varadero feels off the beaten path, giving me a glimpse of the country that isn't reserved for tourists. It will be different when we arrive at our destination, of course. Varadero is one of the country's most famous seaside resort cities. Of all the places I've wanted to visit in Cuba, this is another that's special to me, a place that meant something to my grandmother. The water, Marisol. The most beautiful water you've ever seen. The color of that necklace I bought you. You know the one? Luis's arm drapes around the back of my seat, his other hand tapping the steering wheel, keeping time with the beat of the music on the car's radio. The sun shines down on us, the breeze from the convertible's open top alleviating the heat a bit, but my thighs still stick to the white leather upholstery. When we finally arrive at the beach, I'm hardly disappointed. Varadero is everything my grandmother said it would be. White sand is cut in fine granules. Towering palms loom overhead. The most beautiful, clear water my eyes have ever seen lies before me. It's relatively quiet in this section of beach, and we find a spot off to the side under a palm tree. The nearest sunbather is hundreds of yards away, providing the illusion that we've found our own corner of the world. Luis sets up a blanket for us in the sand, taking out the hamper he brought from home. He pulls out tamales and empanadas wrapped in paper and bottled sodas, handing the food to me. I polish off a tamal and an empanada, washing them down with the familiar taste of materva.
"Do you want to go swimming?"
Luis asks once we've finished eating. The water's impossible to resist. "Of course." I pull the dress over my head, wearing the bikini I changed into earlier during one of our stops along the journey, and turn my back to Luis as I stare at the waves lapping at the shore. A fishing boat hovers in the distance, bobbing up and down in the water. Far to the right of me, tiny straw umbrellas pepper the landscape. This truly is paradise. I imagine scattering my grandmother's ashes here, making her final resting place in the sand and the sea, and yet, I'm not ready to part with her. There's an unfamiliar distance between us. The secret of her mysterious romance lingering between us.
"You think you know someone. Imagine you know them better than anyone. And then little by little, the fabric of their life unravels before your eyes and you realize how little you knew. She was always the constant in my life, and now it feels a bit like I've lost her all over again."
I walk toward the water, not waiting for Luis, taking a moment to get my bearings. To calm the racing beat of my heart, to clear my head. The blue water is like crystal. Fish skimming the surface and flashes of colors dart in and out of the waves. The temperature is more a tepid bath than a bracing dip. The sand slips through my toes.
"Beautiful, isn't it?" Luis asks from his place beside me, his shoulder a hairbreadth from mine.
"It is." I wade farther into the sea. The water undulating against my calves, a fish swimming by, then another. I go deeper, the water up to my knees, then my thighs, Luis trailing somewhere behind me, giving me space. The water grows darker and darker before me until it breaks off, some point beyond the horizon I can no longer see, a home in the United States that suddenly feels very far away. My fingertips trail against the sea as it caresses my navel. I dive under the waves, and when I pop up again, Luis is there, his back to the sun, watching me. It feels like a line of dominoes falling into place, like somehow I was meant to end up here, with the grandson of beloved family friends, my feet on Cuban soil, history catching up to me. I take a step forward, then another. I stop an inch away from Luis, and our lips meet. The salt from the sea between us, the smell of the ocean filling my nostrils, the sun warming his skin beneath my hands, his beard scratchy against my cheek. Ages pass before we come up for air.
"Tell me about your family," Luis says.
We've migrated from the sea to the sand, lounging on a worn blanket he brought with him.
My lips are swollen from his kisses. I pass the drink we've been sharing back to him and stare out at the water. It's an innocent enough question on the surface, but still very complicated beneath it.